Doom Patrol, Negative Man, Elastigirl, Robot Man.
Someone wants the Doom Patrol reunited.
Your every word and action
is being broadcast across the planet.
Now, Monsieur Mana!
Well done, my Doom Patrol. Well done.
It is too late for you, Calder. Your beloved patrol is doomed.
Hello and welcome to Waiting for Doom, the Doom Patrol podcast, where we've been waiting for the Doom Patrol to come back, and it came back, and now we wait between issues.
Yes, hello, I'm Mike. You can find me on Twitter at AvantGarb. You can also find us on Facebook. You can reach us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com. You can also check out mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com for more Doom Patrol goodness from friend of the show, Doug Zavisha. And all our episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and podbean.com.
And I'm Paul. You can find me on Twitter at reading_Hicks. And we also have a sentient show Twitter account, which is Wilfred at WFDPod. And we are sponsored by Comicosity. But today, enough about that stuff. Let's talk about our guest who is with us. Joining us once again, it's Gabe Hardman. The comic writer, artist, movie maker, well, a man of so many talents that we don't have time to list them all. But yes, he is currently writing Invisible Republic, his series with Karina Becco from Image. And yep. It's going bloody well, isn't it? You're, what, issue 13's out?
Yeah, issue 14 comes out soon. I think the second week of January. And we're wrapping up the third arc by February. And then we may take a bit of a break. Because there's another project that we're going to work on in between.
Oh, a secret project?
Well, I'm not telling you.
He told me earlier, Paul. So,
okay, good. Anyway, Gabe is joining us today because we are going to talk about the final issue of Volume 1 of the Doom Patrol, which is pretty well known for when the Doom Patrol dies. So the first time we had Gabe on, which was way back in, I think, May 2015, Gabe was interested in coming back to talk about this one. So, and that time has finally come. So, wow. But anyway, Mike, how was your week in comics?
My week in comics was pathetic. I still have not touched a single new comic book since we last spoke. So I think my reading pile has reached the depressing stage, where it just keeps getting added to, but nothing gets picked up. So maybe in the next week or so, I don't know. But I got to spend Christmas with my family, and that was nice and awesome. And I've spent a lot of time painting Warhammer 40,000 miniatures, and I've become addicted to an iPhone game called Mini Metro, which is about building train lines. And it sounds lame, but it's awesome. It's like, you know what, you're in the train station and you see the maps showing all the different colored routes of all the different train lines? Someone decided, I want to make a game that looks like that. And they did.
Wow.
And it's very addictive. But anyway, yeah, it's been an okay week. Fairly light on comics, but still good spending time with the family nonetheless. How's your week been, Paul?
I actually read a comic. I read Superman American Alien by Max Landis and a host of fantastic artists. So there's Nick Dragota, Tommy Lee Edwards, Joel Jones, Jay Lee, Francis Manipal, Jonathan Case, and Jock. Max Landis, he's a bit of a tool online, is that fair to say? He likes to be provocative. So if everyone says they like something, he'll go in and criticize it and things like that. But he's not the sort of type of tool who, says something nasty about someone who just died. But He can be a bit abrasive online, but I've got to hand it to him. He's a pretty talented writer. I was really impressed with this book. It's sort of like vignettes from Superman's life, starting when he's just struggling to control the power of light with his dad and Martha. And then it jumps ahead a couple of years and shows a bit more of his life, like being a teenager, knowing he has these powers, but never having used them in any intervention. And there's a horrible crime spree going on in Smallville. But it was a terrific little series, and it was really creative. And it painted probably the most human Clark Kent I've seen in comics, the way he just hangs out with his mates and they give each other shit and all that sort of stuff. It was just really natural. And it ends with him discovering his Kryptonian heritage from Lobo, who comes to send a message by blowing up a building in Metropolis and things like that. But it was a fabulous series. I really enjoyed it. And the art was fantastic throughout. Really impressive. The Joel Jones chapter in particular was amazing. So, yeah, I recommend it. Yeah. Okay. Mm. And Gabe, what do you want to talk about your week in comics? Do you want to talk about your year in being a comic maker? Do you want to talk about, you know, whatever you want to talk about? We're throwing over to you just to tell us stuff.
I spent a lot of this year, writing and drawing Invisible Republic with Karina, and I storyboarded Wolverine, Wolverine 3, and spent an enormous amount of time doing that and juggling both of those and ending up with not a lot of time to do anything else. But recently we took a little trip to Costa Rica, and so I was able to read on the plane some, which was good. Although I did read comics, but for the most part, I read The Handmaid's Tale, and then I read a book about 1939, the beginning of World War II. So just I'm mostly just reading miserable stuff to punish myself for living in the United States.
Each their own.
We're all feeling the effect of the global punishment, I feel. I have never seen so many people just as a whole so down about a year. It's unbelievable.
It's been a miserable year.
Yes.
It's horrible. I mean, for those of you who don't know, we woke up this morning to the news that Carrie Fisher had passed away. Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty crap.
Yep. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So many young people. Like, these people aren't old.
No.
No, George Michael and Prince, Darwin Book. It's horrible.
Mm. Yes, hence the anger at the calendar year.
Yes. Anyway, the Doom Patrol.
Yeah, they're full of good cheer and merriment and mirth. Oh, yeah. Wait a minute.
It's right in the name.
Is that the sound of ticking?
It is the ticking of the doom clock. So the last Doom Patrol book we had was kind of recent, issue 3 of volume 6 by Way and Darrington. So it's been a mere 7 weeks since the last Doom Patrol book. Good grief. Issue 4 is due on the stands January 18th, 2017. So just 3 weeks away. The last appearance of the Patrol as a team was 1 year and 20 weeks ago in two different comics, All-Star Section 8 number 3 and Justice League United number 12, but we should have them back in action as a team in issue 6 of the new volume. And as a special treat to Paul, this week in Doom Patrol history, going on sale December 29th, 2004 with the cover date of February 2005, for $2.50 was Doom Patrol Volume 4 number 7 from John Byrne.
Hey!
Paul's favorite run. This issue saw the Patrol take on a cult calling themselves the Devolutionists, who are planning to turn back the evolutionary clock all around the world. And here's a teaser, the giant ape seen fighting the team on the cover of this issue is actually a member of the Patrol. We covered this era of the Patrol in general all the way back in episode 7 from February of 2015, so you can check that out for more details. And that's it for the Doom Clock this week.
We were not kind.
I think next year we should start up some sort of fan drive to help Paul out, because he doesn't have, I think you've got what, maybe 2-3 issues of that run, Paul?
I've got 1, 2, and 3 and nothing else.
Okay, I think we need to get some help from the fans to get you the rest of that run.
Yeah.
We'll have to sort something out. But yeah, we'll do that. Yeah, sure. Anyway, on to doomsplaining.
Well, the day has finally come on Doomsplaining, where we have reached the end of Volume 1, the Arnold Drake, Bruno Premiani run of the Doom Patrol. And it's fair to say they went out with a bang. So this issue, it's issue 121 of Volume 1. It came out, well, it's cover dated September, October 1968. But according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, who has the details, it came out on July 18th, 1968. It cost 12 cents, which is a fair price for a comic, I think. Mm-hmm. It was edited by Murray Boltonoff, and it was entitled The Death of the Doom Patrol. And it's written by Arnold Drake with the art by Bruno Premiani. And it has a fantastic cover by Joe Orlando, who I don't think has done a cover for the Doom Patrol before. But yes, on the cover we can see some very somber-looking Doom Patrol members standing behind their gravestones. And it has a great big banner at the top saying, "Is this the beginning of the end for the Doom Patrol?" And it says, "You decide." That's talking to us. Though at that age, I was a bit too young to decide, I would say. Anyway, inside the comic, under the title heading The Death of the Doom Patrol, the team, the chief, a robot man, Elastigirl, and Negative Man recoil in horror. But this image is on a giant artist board, which has just been finished by artist Bruno Premiani, who turns to his editor, not his writer, Murray Boltonoff, and says, "It's true, Murray? You didn't tell me how to finish this page. You're going to kill our Doom Patrol?" "I don't know, Bruno. It's not up to me. Unless the Marines send help, the Doom Patrol will die after this issue. And you, jolly reader, you are the Marines. Only you can save the Doom Patrol. And I kid you not."
Jolly.
That's how they spoke to readers back then. Mm. Anyway, Bruno then goes on to name and briefly recap the origins of the founding Doom Patrol members. "And now you kill them? That's terrible." Murray restates that it's up to the readers to save them, and the two comic men will tell us how later. And then the story starts proper with a maniacal Madame Rouge, freshly freed from her temporary affiliation to goodness, watching a Parisian school through an overhead bombing target scope. In her sights is the secret headquarters of the Brotherhood of Evil. Down below, the brain in a jar known only as the Brain and his guerrilla partner known as Monsieur Malat are debating the extent of their danger. Malat asks why she is a danger now that she is no longer with the Doom Patrol, but the Brain explains that she now has no one to restrain her. For his part in creating the furnace of evil that burns within her, he is now a target. The conversation is ended by the explosion that sends the duo hurtling into the air. Later at the Doom Patrol headquarters, the chief is monitoring the situation. There's no question that the Brain and the genius gorilla are dead. Larry and Cliff are cool with this. But in the classic Niles modest take on events, the chief declares that this is meant as a warning to him. Their discussion is cut short by the screeching of car tires outside, and the building is sprayed with machine gun fire. It's an old 60s-style drive-by.
Mm.
Larry and Cliff run outside, and Negative Man is soon zooming a hurt bystander off to the hospital. And Cliff starts collecting the casings for the chief to run ballistic tests on. Even better, one of the shells is fully intact. It's a dud. The chief is suspicious and tells Cliff to shove it in the couch just in time as it explodes, destroying the couch. And Cliff's metal hand takes a drink. Madame Rouge knows them too well and is outwitting them at every turn. Meanwhile, at stately Dayton Manor, Steve Dayton, the fifth richest man in the world that we hear occasionally about, is arriving back home from a business dinner with his beautiful wife, Rita Farr. Steve pulls off his shoes and turns on the radio, which immediately reports the attack on the Doom Patrol headquarters. Rita is soon running out the door in her team uniform as Steve smashes the wireless in frustration.
I love his reaction to that. He just takes it out on the radio.
And Rita bursts in only to be immediately confronted by Larry and Cliff packing Tommy guns. Everyone is nervous and worried, with good reason, as the chief identifies three unscheduled aircraft on approach. "It's okay, it's only helicopters hovering overhead to fire napalm all over the building." Luckily, the chief has made the headquarters napalm-proof. I didn't know you could do that. Plus, he's also installed missile launchers on the roof, which, together with Negative Man, make short work of the aerial attackers. In a remarkable bit of bureaucratic efficiency, the smoke of battle hasn't even cleared when a government representative, William Boggs, is on the scene. The attacks on the Doom Patrol have made the team a menace to the entire population. The ultimatum is, come with Boggs to be held in a secret sanctuary or face deportation. Cliff is ready to throw Boggs to the moon, but an embiggened hand from Rita knocks his arm down. The chief reassures Boggs that the Doom Patrol will be gone in 24 hours. Cliff pounds on a wall in frustration.
The next day, the team are at the airport preparing to board a plane as a crowd forms to see them off. Unfortunately, it's not a friendly farewell from the crowd. Instead, our heroes are booed, taunted, and cursed as cowards for leaving. But once they're aboard, Chief actually reveals their destination is a new secret base that he's been preparing for a while. Cliff is so happy he gives the Chief a kiss on the head. And before long, the plane arrives at an island in the Caribbean, and we see a sprawling nuclear-powered base, a tropical Shangri-La with rocket launchers. As the team start unloading the plane and discussing plans for taking care of Rouge, what they don't realise is how close she actually is. because just offshore is a submarine piloted by Nazi Captain Zahl, and he's joined by his new ally, Madame Rouge herself. We learn that Zahl wants revenge on Niles due to the chief inventing anti-U-boat bombs in World War II, which left Zahl disfigured. Oh, the bad guy being affected by Niles once again. And we see Zahl's demolition squad, clad in scuba gear, launch themselves from the sub and begin their attack on the island. The patrol's plane is blown up. Cliff chases after them, exclaiming, "Okay, Frogman, prepare to do some real croaking." And he begins to take them out. Robotman pushes Elastigirl to safety just as two of the attackers hurl a now-detached plane landing gear in her direction. And with his anger now rising, Cliff knocks down a palm tree and uses it to clobber more of the attackers. But just then, the submarine surfaces, and much to Chief's surprise, he sees Captain Zahl appear on the sail. That's the top part of a submarine, apparently. And Zahl says, "Yeah, Dr. Calder, your old friend Captain Zahl. An unpleasant surprise, Nine, especially since the War Crimes Commission declared me dead 15 years ago. Oh, wow. I love that this is the first time we see Zahl, and there's already this, you know, history between them. Zahl then unleashes three specialized attacks to incapacitate the patrol. A cannon blasts the beach where Larry stands, completely covering him in sand. And while at first this seems a pointless attempt, we learn the blast turned the sand radio resistant, and it's now imprisoned the negative being within him. And Rita expands into giant mode, but is then snared in a steel net trap, which, despite her current size, she somehow doesn't have the strength to bust out of it. But Cliff tries to help her escape the net, and a beam of electricity hits him, leaving him lying prone on the ground. And Chief makes his way to the trio and deduces that it must have been a magnetic charge, disabling all his internal working. Comic book science, everyone! Yay! Chief tells Zahl that he and Rouge have won this round, but Zahl is determined to humiliate Niles further. Zahl reveals two different control buttons and asks the Chief, "Would you die for a handful of stupid, ordinary men? Would you die for the smallest part of mankind? One bomb will destroy the town of Codsville, Maine, with a population of 14. The other bomb will sink this island. You have 2 minutes to decide." Niles turns to the patrol. "You heard him. 14 ordinary men, strangers to us. What do we decide?" "Strangers," replies Larry. "Didn't you teach us that all men are our brothers?" Rita mentions the pilgrims. They were just ordinary men too. Not a genius among them. And Cliff joins in. The Hebrew children, who wouldn't bow to the Pharaoh, just ordinary shepherds and farmers. And so joining hands, our heroes turn to Zahl and give their answer. Far away. Despite Rouge's frantic last-minute request to let them live, Zahl gleefully presses a button and the island explodes. The news spreads quickly around the world, with one report asking, "Could all the super deeds of that astounding group ever equal this single lesson in courage?" And the 14 residents of Codsville agree to rename their home Four Heroes in honour of the team's sacrifice. And finally, we see Steve Dayton on a yacht, dropping a single rose into the ocean, the water still boiling from the destruction of the island, and he vows to spend every last dollar to destroy those who took Rita from him. But the somber mood changes suddenly as the final panel takes us back to Bruno Premiani and Murray Boltanoff. Bruno stands before a drawing of the exploding island and comments, "Then it's true, the Doom Patrol are dead and will never fight again." To which Murray replies, "It would take a miracle to change that ending, Bruno, and only you out there, the reader, could do it. You always wanted to be a superhero, didn't you? Okay, let's see you try." And we're left with the final words, "The end, or is it?" Oh.
Well, yes, it is the end.
They're dead.
The readers did not rally and save the book.
No, they didn't. They didn't care.
And I think this is the single most important aspect of this book. I mean, it obviously is because it's the thing it's remembered for. Mm. But it's the important aspect of the book because it tells you how the real world works.
Yes.
Nobody cares. Nobody's going to come and save you. The superheroes are not going to save you. Mm-hmm. Everything's going to end horribly. I'm sorry. It's just true.
And there was also, I mean, at the same time this is going on, there was a lot of internal dispute at DC. Like Arnold Drake was involved with Bob Haney, and they were trying to drum up interest in getting better conditions. So they were looking for, you know, health and better page rates. And right. At this stage, I mean, artists were seen as important, and writers were seen as, you know, you could exchange them out in a moment's notice, and it didn't really matter. I mean, it wasn't long till before this they didn't even have their names in the comics. So a bit of this was going on, and apparently the publisher of DC at the time, Erwin Donnerfeld, had a grudge against Drake and actually had him removed from this comic. So it was meant to be Drake speaking instead of the editor, Murray Boltonoff. But Donnerfeld ordered him redrawn at the last minute. Yeah, there is actually, I've seen the original art, which has Drake in it instead.
Oh, great. Oh, I should look that up. I had no idea. I know that Drake had been involved in trying to do some kind of unionizing in the 60s. And, you know, talking about a union in comics even now is something that, will quiet a room very quickly. So it's still a very touchy subject.
It's a shortcut to a different field of work, isn't it?
Apparently.
Yeah. So a lot of the, John Broom disappeared at this time and... Bob Haney got a bit more work, but it was tough for the writers at this point. And they couldn't get artists to join them. Apparently that was the thing that they believe led to their failure, though I would actually wonder if having anyone join them would have helped at this point in time.
Interesting. And then Neil Adams tried to do this again a few years later and made some more significant attempt, although it also didn't really work out. So, an artist.
Yeah, but it's good that everything's better in the comic industry now and everyone's treated well.
This is not a good road. Look, all I have to say is I'm in a union. I'm in the Art Directors Guild, and so I get health benefits from them, and I'm through the movie stuff, so I'm happy to have that, and I think it's important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean... It must be horrible not to have security for your family and know that you're creating these things that will last beyond you and make money way beyond you. I mean, it's 2016 and we have Doom Patrol Volume 6 before us, and there are runs of the Doom Patrol that are getting reprinted and collected and, sold to, people who weren't alive when they first came out. And it's a cash cow. There's so many things in comics that are cash cows. Like the Lego Batman movie trailer just came out and there's throwaway villains in that are jokes that are now going to be money-making, like Condiment King and Orca.
Right.
And
I think that I don't want to sound like a corporate shill or something, but I guess the other side of this is that it's not, I do believe that there should be protections for this, but it also, you also do know what you're doing. You're signing on to do freelance work. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, nobody's under the misapprehension that they own stuff from Marvel and DC Comics, or rather Disney and Warner Brothers. And you're also able to do your own stuff that you own, but it's a risk that you're taking by not necessarily getting paid for it up front. So, it's a tough situation. And I think that, there should be better protections for people. But a lot of this comes down to the fact that, there's few protections for people in the United States in general. So, there's very little of a social safety net. So so it doesn't give people the opportunity to be entrepreneurial in a way, like, either making your own comics or working as a freelancer for things that don't where the business itself doesn't have those kind of protections. This is good Doom Patrol stuff here.
Yeah, it's great. So Gabriel, I'm interested to know when was it that you first read issue 121 of the Patrol and what were your initial thoughts on it the first time you read it?
I mean, I knew I was aware of it, but it was not long after. I had started picking I knew of them from the Teen Titans, and I had started finding, beat up back issues in bins in the comic store where in the town where I lived, mm-hmm. the semi comic store, and so I'd started reading those, and the guy who ran the store knew that I was interested in this, and then a copy of 121 came in, and so he sort of taunted me with it, because it was expensive relative to whatever comics I was buying. Mm. But I did buy it. I still have that copy of it. And you know, when I read it, I mean, it always appealed to me. The idea that they died in the end always appealed to me. And that was now, you know, at the time in the late 80s, 20 years later, and they had never really come back. The Doom Patrol series that would morph into the Grant Morrison Doom Patrol would start right around this time or right after it. Mm-hmm. And so I love the idea that they died. I love the idea that they didn't come back after that. And it gave it this kind of weight and history along with this. They're ludicrous too. You know, I mean, they're silly characters in a lot of ways. They're a robot and a mummy and a giant lady. And putting those two tones together, I wouldn't have probably put it this way when I was 13 years old, but putting that kind of goofy tone together with the tragic thing, was something that, I mean, that still appeals to me. That's something that still appeals to me. The story itself is, I mean, you recapped it. It's a sort of series of repetitive action episodes, you know? Yeah. And so it doesn't do that much. And the thing that I like the most about the Doom Patrol is this ending. And I liked these characters, but what really drew me into the book was Bruno Premiani and the art and that kind of lush line that he had, and something that maybe to people who are not artistically inclined doesn't look that different from a lot of other Silver Age stuff, but to me looked very, very dramatically different, and was appealing to me.
Yeah. So coming back to Bruno, what sort of evolution do you see in his art over the course of the series?
I mean, I think that the biggest thing are two things. I mean, it looks to me like he spends less time on it as he goes, and it goes faster and faster as he goes. Because I mean, things like the splash page early on in this issue, where she's like looking through that viewer, and that feels so fast. That looks like he knocked that out as quick as possible. There's earlier stuff in the series that feels more crafted and more finely done. Although I do think some of his best work is in the series in the early and mid part. But I think another thing that that changes the look of it as it goes is they go from he goes from drawing it on the 2-up size paper, the paper that's larger than the size we do now, to 11x17 inch paper that's standard size at this point. And so some of that tighter looking stuff that he does earlier on, I think, just looks looser because he's drawing it smaller.
Right.
So, and that would probably be faster as well. But I imagine that was just some sort of industry change or some, you know, change at DC where they wanted to probably save money on that little bit of paper, you know. But
And you know this because you have a piece of art from issue 118, don't you?
I do, yeah, I do. It's the smaller size, but it's actually a half splash. So it's the pages that are where there would be an ad, a house ad, right, for half the bottom half of the page.
Yep.
So it's the top half of the page, and it's Beast Boy as a bat, and he's flying at a guy whose innards all show, and
Phoenix.
Like that sort of goofiness is great, but I do really love just the craftsmanship of Bruno Premiani. Mm.
So how do you feel about the Doom Patrol coming back after this? We talked to Paul Kupperberg, and he said that he regretted creating the new team, and he should have just, had the chief turn off a force field and they wouldn't walk away from this.
I think he's wrong. I would say Paul Kupperberg is wrong, despite the fact that it's his own work I'm talking about. And I'll tell you why. As sort of lousy as that 70s team is, the fact that they're not as good as the original ones, it is kind of makes the original people stronger. You know, it feels like it reinforces the early concept. If he just magically said, hey, they were alive the whole time, then I think that would take away a lot of that bigger pathos. Even though, I reread that stuff recently, the 70s stuff. And, it's not great, but there is an element of, I think the sadness of Cliff Steele is important. You know, I think the fact he's the lonely robot man who doesn't have his people anymore is, you know, I mean, that had as much impact on me as anything, because I was also, you know, I picked up those 60s ones and I found the 70s ones around the same time. And so, you know, I mean, I'm getting it all at once, but the but like it seemed to me like, you know, they all died except for him. And then he comes back because he's a robot. But then he's, you know, he's God's lonely man now. Right. So like who doesn't have like his compatriots anymore. And they died tragically, but he survived. He's got this survivor guilt aspect. And I think that period in the 70s is important to keep that, you know, to make that, you know, something. And then I believe in the Titans, when he comes back, there's a, you know, looking for his, you know, his long lost people element to it as well. And like, I just think that that's better. You know, I mean, if they just magically came back, it would just be, you know, that you wouldn't remember it any more than any other thing where, you know, where some character died and they came back, you know, later, and it didn't make any difference at all.
It certainly does. I like that it continues the legacy of the original team, but it adds something new to it at the same time. So, and we covered that Titan story where Steve Dayton and Robot Man are basically looking for Captain Zarl and, you know, trying to avenge the original team. Right. Yeah.
Now, I hadn't realized that Zarl was just created for this story. I always had the impression that he was around earlier, even though I have read everything before this. I mean, he really is a very throwaway character.
Mm.
Yeah, I had never, I mean, like, I hadn't read the whole series until, I mean, I guess I collected most of the series, but I hadn't read it in one big run until, you know, maybe the, like, early 2000s or something, like when the, those kind of black and white phone books came out.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were, I still had sort of scattered issues. And so, as like, I had it in my head that that guy had been there and, you know, been around at some point. And that this was, there was a, you know, there was more weight to this than, hey, I'm, you know, an unfrozen Nazi or whatever. I'm here to kill you. Like,
I mean, Rouge just magically manages to team up with him. And, oh, look, they're both out to get Nile. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, it does also have that feeling of, well, I probably not. But if it has this feeling like maybe they're, you know, there could be more to this story if the story had continued, and, you know, and there could be payoffs for this if the story continued. But I'm guessing there probably wouldn't have been anyway. So.
Well, one thing that puzzles me about it is throughout the, you know, Rouge's previous appearance in 119 and then in this, she's out to get the patrol and she's out to get Niles. And then it's like at the last moment, she changes her mind. And when Zarl says, oh, I'm going to blow them up, she's like, oh, no, you swore that you'd keep them alive and don't kill them. And, oh, you've killed them. You've betrayed me. And it's like, what?
Yeah, it's just fake conflict. It's just like, you know, it's just like, oh, it's, they can't just, you know, I mean, you get yourself into these situations, you know. And, or maybe it's, you know, maybe it's an editorial change or something to make it feel like there's more conflict there than there is. Yeah. Because it's pretty, everything in the issue, apart from the relative coolness of them dying, is pretty rote and pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Except there is a good element there where when they're leaving and everybody is horrible and they mock the common man just mocks them and tells them to go away and calls them cowards. When they have their crisis moment and they have to make a decision, It's a question of defending the common man, even though the last time they interacted with the common man, they were treated horribly by them.
It's a nice bit of
poetry. So, you know, there's an arc there anyway.
Mm.
So what have you personally taken away from the Doom Patrol and applied in your approach to it? I mean, yeah, I know you came from an artistic mother, was that right?
And,
yeah. So what have you learned from Bruno?
I mean, it's hard to say because in a lot of ways, I don't think that I have a lot in common stylistically with Bruno Premiani, but I think that it's that I could just appreciate the level of craft and control in the lines that he puts down and the way that he draws animals and the way that he's committed to drawing, sort of real world things in a, you know, in a credible way. I mean, like one of the, you know, if you ask me to pick out the best pages or panels from this issue, you know, some of them would be, you know, like the page, the panel where Steve Dayton is taking his shoe off, you know, I mean, like that little piece of business is the kind of thing that a hackier artist would never think to put in there, you know, and it makes it feel like more of a world and makes it feel like him more of a character because he's taking his shoe off and he's turning and looking at and listening to the radio and it gives it, you know, it's Premiani thinking like, you know, to, I don't like necessarily comparing, you know, films and comics or whatever, but like, you know, thinking like a director, thinking here's our scene and, you know, and the characters have to be doing something. They're not just sitting there staring at each other, you know, talking at each other. They're doing something within the set, within the little world. And I have to like dramatize what's going on and I have to give them little pieces of business and I have to like, you know, have them act like human beings. And I think that he does that over and over again, in ways that, you know, that make his work rise above other people.
Yeah. And I mean, we noticed in the previous episode and issue that, there's a zoom in on one of the villain as he rants and it goes right into his eye.
Yeah.
And that seemed, you know, we both commented, I mean, we don't pick up art stuff the way you would, but we both commented that was seemed very cinematic.
Yeah.
There's a page late in this issue where, you know, when he's threatening them and it's the whole page is cutting back and forth between Niles and Zal, and it's, and like, you know, look at the angles that he chooses. It goes from a close-up of Zal, a head-on close-up of Zal, to a head-on close-up of Niles, and then a low angle up past Zal's hand to a high angle, a corresponding high angle, right? It's Zal's looking down at Niles. Niles is looking up at Zal. Mm-hmm. Another different up angle on Zal as he turns away a little bit. And then an up angle past Calder's hand as he grips the edge of the wheelchair. So that's, you know, it's like he has limited resources here. He has limited ways to show how these people are reacting. But they but like in each thing, he uses something to each choice of angle, each little beat where, you know, the hand is grabbing or the hand is on the plunger and it gets closer and closer on Zal. All those things are great choices that, you know, that create tension, even when, you know, some of the script is kind of hacky.
And it heightens the intensity as they go.
Yeah.
It's interesting you said about Bruno drawing animals, because when I think of your career, I think you've drawn a lot of gorillas. You did Agents of Atlas, and then you did Planet of the Apes and things like that. Yeah. How did you approach having to draw to gorillas all the time?
You know, it's, I mean, there are things where, you know, there are things that sort of naturally complement your style, and there are things that don't. And the things that don't, you have to work really hard on. But drawing gorillas is something that is not so difficult, and it connects with real world stuff in a way. Like I like to go to the zoo and draw from life and keep a sketchbook and do. I mean, I don't do it as much as I should or would like to, just for time reasons. But I like to be able to, and I think that. And with something like a gorilla, who is a primate, and they have a level of expressiveness that is very relatable to people, but is not exactly a person. You know, their eyes are close together, and they're, you know, I mean, and in Planet of the Apes, I'm just drawing people in ape masks. You know, those are basically human proportions. So it's not the same thing. But like with Gorilla Man in Atlas, there's just something appealing about being able to draw. And, you know, for me, I draw in a way that's expressive, but not, you know, the expressions are not heavy handed, right? I don't like to telegraph things to the audience reader. I don't like to tell them exactly what a character is thinking. I want the reader to infer what a character is thinking based on the dialogue and the situation and the look on their face. So, like, there were great moments through that book where, you know, Jeff Parker would write a joke and, you know, I would just feel like, you know what, I'm confident enough. Gorilla Man's got a dry sense of humor. That's, you know, I'm confident that this joke will play even if I basically have him deliver it with a straight face. And, you know, and I think that another, you know, if you were worried about drawing that expression and getting that expressiveness across, you would make it a big, giant, jokey smirk or laugh or whatever, because you're afraid people won't understand that it's supposed to be a joke. And I'm never afraid that people aren't going to understand something, probably to my detriment, you know, but like I just feel like you either do it or you don't do it. And if you're trying to telegraph things to people and try to tell them, you know, what it is you're gonna what it is they're supposed to feel by you know, by just broadcasting at them, what you ultimately end up with will be much, much less. So I don't know how I got to there, but but it had something to do with gorillas.
Doesn't it always?
I mean, it's sparking off things that I see anyway. Like, Invisible Republic is filled with enigmatic people whose motives are mysterious, and, you know, you never extend of the, you know, how much is this person a hero and how much is this person a villain across the board. And in the midst of that, you know, you've drawn this monstrous dog, which is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it felt like a little bit of an indulgence, but the third arc of the series is set on a different planet in the same solar system. And it's a planet with lush jungles and a lot of wildlife and things that that you didn't see in the earlier part, where the planet is kind of desolate. And so the dog had come from that planet long before. We kind of find out the origins of that dog in the third arc. So dog in quotes, it's a big monster guy. And there's a lot of fun in being able to take what is, you know, we put a lot of limits on ourselves for it being science fiction in Invisible Republic, because it's, you know, it's a very kind of, you know, it's not a fantastical world. It's mm-hmm. it's a very, very lived in world, in a world that doesn't have, you know, amazing, wondrous things in it. But we're able to introduce those kind of elements as we go along and as we broaden the scope of the world of it. But like, as you're talking about the, you know, who's a hero and who's a villain and everything, I mean, I think that the thing is, like, the stuff I like the most is there aren't heroes and villains. You know, they're just people, and people who are making decisions, and people who are trying to get through the world. And sometimes they'll act heroically, and sometimes they won't, and sometimes they'll be cowards, and sometimes they'll, you know, they'll do good stuff. And in some ways, the Doom Patrol, the 60s Doom Patrol, is a relatively straightforward superhero book with just some goofball dressing on top of it. But there are other ways where, I mean, I think it is kind of a little more ambiguous than certainly a lot of things that you would think of as a DC comic at the time. Well, so I think that probably appealed to me as well. You know?
Yeah, there's an undercurrent of, except like Gar has lots of troubles at college or school or wherever he is, and, you know, there's a undercurrent of, you know, he needs to just accept who he is, and everyone needs to accept who he is, and he shouldn't have to change.
Mm, yeah.
Which is, you know, pretty cool in 68.
You know, and I mean, I think in 68 it might even be a little bit retrograde for the culture, but it's probably, you know, pretty good for comics. It's
progressive for comics, yes.
Especially DC comics, you know. This is not a shot at DC comics. I mean, and if it is, it's the DC comics of 1968. Mm. So if, like, Joe Orlando wants to come kick my ass or something, fine. But, you know, they were, I think anybody would say that they were not the hippest place in the world back then.
Mm.
No. A lot of people were looking at Marvel and going, hey, why don't we do that?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, anything else we could say about this issue? What do you think of the cover?
I mean, it's fine. It's Joe Orlando, right? It's. I think it's a good, iconic cover. I think that, Orlando did some great horror stuff and things in the pre-superhero days, which I'm sure, you know, he, like a lot of those guys, were less in less interested in superheroes than in other genre stuff. I think it's a nice iconic cover. I think that it's not, you know, it's the drawing is not the greatest in the world, but it's good otherwise.
I think it sets the mood of the issue definitely from yes. the get-go. Yeah.
It's funny, for such an iconic cover, I don't think I've ever seen it, ripped off or no. homaged.
No, I guess there's a lot of grave-oriented covers, though, right? I
mean, yeah.
You know, every other Batman cover has a grave on it.
This but, is true.
Oh, yeah, you know what? Just a quick thing. Speaking of Joe Orlando, he was the first guy I ever really met in professional comics, and when I was 16, I went and showed him my portfolio. So, and he was not super nice to me, but it was set up by somebody else and who'd seen my portfolio and knew him. And I went up to the offices at DC and he was the art director there at the time. And I showed him my portfolio. And he was pretty gruff, and he showed me an Alex Raymond strip on the wall and told me I should, you know, study him and, you know, and do better stuff like that, and basically sent me on my way. But it was still a meaningful first step into me being a comic artist.
Cool.
Just not to throw out Joe Orlando, like I had no idea who he was.
So he would come and kick your ass, is what you're saying?
I think so, yeah. I think so.
So, Paul, what are your final thoughts on the issue?
It made me sad. I mean, I guess... I mean, I came at this completely the wrong way around. Like, I'd done all of Volume 2 and, you know, Volume 5 and things like that before I even read these.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew of them. And all of Volume 1 has been a journey. And I guess I didn't expect to feel so much for the characters. Like, I mean, I'm cynically dismissive of Silver Age comics and 60s comics, and, you know, like, they're not as sophisticated and they're not the things I need in a comic. But, I mean, it's been a blast talking about them, but I really cared for Rita through this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Rita is a fantastic female character considering, you know, what else was going on in, you know, comics at the time, and DC comics particularly. You know, she is a real go-getter. She won't be held back. She gets married, but she doesn't care what her husband wants her to do. Even though he is overtly, you know, stop superheroing and just hang with me.
Mm.
And she's filled with compassion, and, you know, she puts her feelings and thoughts into actions and, you know, tries to make things better for, like, particularly Beast Boy. So... I didn't have the sense of what a loss her character's death was until I came back and read these stories.
Mm.
Yeah. So, yeah, but as an issue itself, this is a classic capper to a series. And it you're right, it is special because this happened and it wasn't undone.
Yes.
But Rita's the one who never really comes back, right? I mean, maybe she does, you know, John Byrne or whatever, but like through the stuff in the 80s, she's the one who stays dead in through the Grant Morrison stuff, right?
Yes. She does return in the Giffen Clark series, and that's
right.
explained.
But that's like a reboot, right? Or is that still supposed to be in the world of the same thing?
It's post Infinite Crisis when all the continuities have merged.
Right. Well, yeah. There you go.
So it kind of is. But it's explained in a way that's, you know, semi believable. So
okay.
And we'll get to that. We'll get to that. That.
All right. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to jump the gun.
No. Right. It's fine. It's fine. it's all good. Yeah. I really enjoyed this as a finale to the series. Of course, I was sad to see the team go. And you're right about Rita. She's like the human heart of the team, and I've always appreciated the way Bruno drew her as just a regular woman. She wasn't done up in sexy clothes, and she just looked normal within the team, even though she had this fantastic ability. That's something I always appreciated about her in the book. She was just a regular woman who happened to be able to shrink and expand herself. So, you know. But yeah, I'm still kicking myself that at Heroes Con this year, I held a copy of the issue in my hands, but I didn't buy it. because of the price. Even though they were discounting stuff, still the price. So maybe one day. Maybe one day. But yeah, I also love the fact that the team's demise was animated in Batman the Brave and the Bold series as well. So, and essentially the same sort of thing. Zal, you know, kidnaps the team and gives them the same ultimate choice, and they make the same decision, and, you know, Batman gives them a bit of a sad send-off. So it was nice. Well, not for a given value of nice. It was nice to see that history of the Patrol respected and sent out to a larger audience as well. So, yeah.
You know, actually, at New York Comic Con, like 4 years ago, 5 years ago, like I held in my hands the last like two pages of this issue, the original art, and a dealer there was selling them, and somebody told me about it because they knew I love Premiani. And I went over there and I tried to get them, and they were very expensive, but not as expensive as they should be for, you know, for what they were. Like, the guy didn't quite know. Mm-hmm. But we're still talking about thousands of dollars. And so, like, I tried to buy one of them, and this dealer would not take a credit card. Like, he was, you know, and so, like, and I'm just, you know, I'm an artist. I have a table, so I'm not carrying everything with me, right? Mm. And, I went back to my table to see if I had enough cash to buy it. And by the time I got back over there, like, somebody else had bought it or something, so I lost out. But it sucked. But, you know, art dealers.
Well, yeah. Step above carnies, just.
Depends on which one.
So have you had the opportunity to draw the Doom Patrol much? Do you do many Doom Patrol commissions? Do people...
No one is
the word out there that people know you love them?
Maybe one person has asked me. No one cares what I love. No one cares what I want to draw with these commissions. I think maybe I've done one Doom Patrol commission, but I think that's probably about it. It just hasn't come up that much, oddly. Probably because they're not very popular. I don't know if you've, like, heard doing this Doom Patrol podcast.
But, you wound us, sir.
They're actually not terribly popular.
This is the eye of the storm for the lack of perspective on things, okay? We don't really understand what the rest of the world thinks.
No, I do know. I did do a Doom Patrol commission because I remember that I had multiple commissions that I had, you know, I'd worked up, and somebody came to the table looking for their commission and told me their name, and I was like, "Oh, was yours the Doom Patrol commission?" And he was like, "Oh God, no." So, you know, that. That was sort of an indication.
Wow.
No, that wasn't us.
No, it wouldn't have been us. No.
No.
Oh, dear. Well, I think that we've doomsplained that issue, and now that entire volume of Doom Patrol has been doomsplained. So let's move on to the Mailbag of Doom.
Okay, so this time on the Mailbag of Doom, for the final one for the year, we asked our listeners, what is the worst continuation, prequel or sequel, to something? And we heard first off from Fractures, going by Dr. Frankenstein this week. He said, House of Cards, Season 3 onwards.
Ooh, yes. Yes, I haven't watched past 3 yet, but 3 wasn't good.
Right. Okay.
That's the American House of Cards, I'm just saying he's talking about.
Right.
I'm pretty sure.
Sure.
We heard from Unlikely Nerd, who's Christmas Squirrel on the Twitter, and he said Donald Trump's impending presidency, or the Star Wars prequels, or Schumacher's Batman, or Godfather 3, or Final Fantasy 13. Wow.
It's a wide net he's cast there.
That's quite a spray.
Oh, look, Aaron Long at G005. He said Doom Patrol number 2, the sequel to issue 1. You know what?
That's a regular representation of the rest of the world, isn't it?
Yeah.
We heard from I'm the Gun, and he said, My Summer Story, Christmas Story sequel. Thanks for Mark Gray for jogging my memory in a recent tweet.
I never knew they did that sequel.
It must be a good one that we've never heard of it.
We heard from Fractures again. He's back with more. He said, Matrix Reloaded, except for the chase scene on the highway, and Matrix Revolutions. Mm-hmm. Dark Knight Returns 2, just no. And the Star Wars prequels, apart from Darth Maul. He was cool.
We heard from our favorite doctor, Dr. Ange 70, and he said, Star Wars prequels of Godfather 3, and then he said, comics, Pollux, Doom Patrol, all of the New 52. Ooh.
Ooh. Wow. Touchy. Craig 101 at Craig R. McD said, Batman and Robin, the movie, Jaws, the Revenge, and Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Also, 2016.
We heard from at Putpie, who said, you mean aside from The Empire Strikes Back? And then a wink. So a little bit of sarcasm there, I hope.
Mm-hmm. At Rickety OB, Richie O'Hara Beeman said, Wreck 2. I bloody loved Wreck. And number 2 was so bad, it made me retroactively scowl at the original a little. Fully excited to soon watch 3 and 4, though. Okay.
Okay. We heard from Bob Garnellis at Slermo, and he said, one for each category, DK2. Batman, not Donkey Kong. He's specified. Super Mario Brothers 2 and Godfather 3, Terminator 3 in a tie.
Wow.
Mm.
Nicholas at Nick RDE said, The Matrix steadily descended into non-comprehensible brain pulp. Right?
Our buddy Kevin at Astrakis 1, who's Am Leech View Trinket on Twitter. He does an anagram of his name every now and again. And he said, so many possibilities, but I'll say Joel Schumacher's Batman sequels.
Mm. Jonathan Dick, at Real Last Name, said, The Thing prequel, pointless and inferior to the original in every way. Fair call.
And over on Facebook, we heard from Jared Driscoll, who said, Ghostbusters 2, Bobby Brown's theme song isn't as good as the Ray Parker Jr. original theme song. Yeah, I think there's more problems than just that with that film.
That's bold stuff there.
Not as good, definitively. All right.
Who's going next? Who wants to fess up?
You want to burn any bridges, Gabe?
I don't know. I mean, I'm going to say... I don't think that Brian Yuzna's Bride of Reanimator is as good as Stuart Gordon's Reanimator. I think that it went down a wrong road there.
Sounds like very current.
Right.
Sorry.
No, that's a fair call.
I think that I would say that most of the choices people made are fish in a barrel. You know, everybody agrees on that stuff. But you want to really make a statement, talk about Reanimator movies.
Right.
Wow.
All right, you, Paul.
I don't want to follow that up.
All right, I'll get mine out of the way because it's kind of weird. I get why Marvel does it, and there's no way they're going to stop doing it. But the way they end a series, as soon as they get into double digits... and then continue on with a brand new series for the exact same characters, the exact same team. I hate it. I absolutely hate it. And they do it all the time. And then they reboot with Marvel Now and Marvel Now and Marvel Brand New Now. And it's like, no, just fucking stick to your guns and, you know, don't be afraid of double digits, you idiots.
Wait a second. What difference does it make? Are they the same team?
Yeah,
and they're continuing the story. You're just reading a good book.
Yeah,
don't worry about it.
It just drives me nuts, though. I'm going to stop there because I'm just going to go off on a rant for another 20 minutes. But I don't like it. It just seems silly and pointless to rebrand and relaunch. You know, twice in a year. You know, it's like Anyway, Paul, go now.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of scared to say this in front of Gabe, knowing what a film buff he is. I quite enjoyed City Slickers.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. But when the sequel came out, it was so bad, it made me hate the original. So it actually damaged the original.
Wait, completely. Are you talking about the search for Curly's gold?
Yeah.
That's what he's talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, that's horrible. That's a terrible movie. Slickers is a fun movie. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah,
it's a fun movie. But the second one is so rehashy, it completely destroys any integrity the first one had. Because, you know, they bring back, you know, Curly comes back, but it's his brother. And, you know, and they all go back to the, you know, homestead. Or, it's bad.
Well, I'm sorry that it's ruined the first one for you. Because, yeah, the first one was good fun.
I prefer to think of Westworld as the sequel to City Slickers.
Oh, my God.
One thing from the previous thing, somebody said Jaws 4 the Revenge. I'm willing to defend Jaws 4 the Revenge. Wow. I think that... I would say that Jaws 2 and certainly Jaws 3D are worse in a lot of ways than Jaws 4 the Revenge, which, while totally misguided, is a sort of strange Freudian fever dream of a movie about a shark chasing people like across, you know, from across continents and like it's a phantom of the mind, you know. I mean, there's something more interesting and deep and psychological about Jaws 4 the Revenge than a lot of people give credit to.
That is one of two things I remember about Jaws 4 is the shark travels around the country to kill
them.
And the other thing is that Michael Caine bought a restaurant with the profits.
Yes. Well, yeah.
You want me to record in the Caribbean? Sure.
Yeah, I think that I remember, as a little kid and stuff, I always watched the Oscars, and when I think Michael Caine was nominated maybe for Hannah and Her Sisters, and won. I can't remember if that was the right movie, but he won an Oscar, and his acceptance speech was from the set of Jaws 4: The Revenge, and like. Which is an amazing thing to say about an actor's career.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
Fully paid trip to the sunny location for a few weeks.
Yeah.
Why not?
Although, on the sequel letdown thing, I think that the Back to the Future movies could be... an argument could be made for the Back to the Future movies, even though I do kind of like the other two Back to the Future movies in ways where I don't think that they work the way the first one does. But, I mean, I hated the second one when I saw it, when it first came out.
Wow.
And, it's a mess. The movie is a mess. Especially the first half of it is almost unwatchable with the bizarre over-the-top performances and and makeups and weird choices and all the shit that goes on in that. And I kind of like the third one. But there is, you know, I think that they both totally missed the boat on how to make a coherent sequel to Back to the Future, but also went so far over into some weird meta style of storytelling that it almost becomes an interesting thing unto itself. I'm of two minds about it.
I think we've got a new podcast here.
Wow.
Okay. Oh, dear. Anyway, before we wrap up the Mailbag Doom, I just wanted to apologize to Scott Arthur. I forgot his name last week. I was struggling to remember who does the LGC blog, and I knew it was some bloke, and I'd forgotten his name. It was Scott Arthur. Thank you, Scott. Your blog is amazing. He did the piece about the time bubbles, and the perspective of the time bubble for that Doom Patrol Legion of Substitute Heroes story. So, check out his site, LGC Doom Patrol. It's very cool.
Cool.
Yes. All right. So moving on, let's wrap things up there. Now, it's the end of the year. We're going to take a week off, I think, Mike, aren't we?
I think we're going to need to after today.
Yeah. I'd like to thank Gabe for joining us. Gabe, is there anything you want to plug?
I think I basically plugged everything already. No, that's not correct. I have a horror one-shot called The Belfry that I wrote and drew that is coming out in February 22nd from Image. And you can still pre-order it. So if you want a slightly surreal, but it's sort of like somebody described it back to me as like a Twilight Zone episode with creatures from Stan Winston. And it's it's a horror one shot, and it's a sort of one and done little story, horror story. And I basically just did it for the fun of it and didn't tell anybody I was doing it. And then, printed a couple copies to sell at New York Comic Con, pitched it to Image, and they agreed to put it out. So it's coming out on February 22nd. And, if you ask your retailer to order it, I would appreciate it.
Excellent.
Okay. That's a sequel to Kinski?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's about a island of bat people and the dog that they steal.
I was just going to say, the giant dog from Invisible Robot.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's really bringing together like the different facets of my career and the different...
It's the Hardman universe, it's all coming together.
It's a sort of Crisis on Infinite Earths level thing from, encompassing the... Hardman, and to some degree, the Becca Hardman universe.
Mm, yeah, love it. Fantastic.
Wow.
The Belfry, go and order it, everyone. You won't be sorry. You may be confused, but you won't be sorry. All right, if you want to get in touch with us, you can send tweets to Wilfred at WFDpod, email waitingfordoom@gmail.com. Check out Doug's site, mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com. In a few days, he'll have pictures of the issue we've been talking about and some little art treats. We'll try and get in the alternate art with Arnold Drake in it instead of Murray Boltonoff.
Cool.
And we have a Facebook page, Waiting for Doom Facebook. Go find it. So when we return in the new year, I'm pretty sure we'll be coming back for a Gerard Way, Nick Darrington issue of Doom Patrol if they stick to the schedule at this point. So issue 4 should be out. And the question of the week... my heart's not in this question of the week anymore after this morning's news. The question is, what was the best thing about 2016? And I'm pretty sure the answer is nothing. But, maybe we'll let that one go. People can find their happiness somewhere with that.
Maybe.
Well, at least there's an incredibly low bar for good things.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Oh.
And you can't say things out loud because it might still happen.
Yeah.
At this point.
Just keep it on next year, guys. Yeah.
Anyway, thank you, everybody, for joining us for another year of Waiting for Doom. It's been fun and a real pleasure.
Yes, it's been lots of fun. Talk to you all again in the new year, and keep waiting for Doom.